I'm Stephanie Sigmund. I'm not a rabbi. I'm a professor here. I also was a graduate student here. And
this is the 30th anniversary of the ordination of women. I'm not sure how important that is to you. It's an occasion to come together and study, but it's...
Hello.
Marion, right?
Yeah.
From Anshe Chesed a long time ago.
Oh.
Yeah. We're going to go ahead and not do the introductions, but introduction to myself. So I got my PhD here in Jewish history, and I was focused on Jewish women, but the PhD was in actually communal and social Jewish history. Then I went off and taught for about 13, 14 years out there in the world at University of Florida, at University of Michigan, and then I decided to come back here, and now I teach here. So because I don't have a watch...
Could I borrow it?
I wish I knew how to set this. It says I'm 11 minutes of my time, but unfortunately I'm only 8.
On my watch it's 8.
Great.
9:08.
And we only have 52 minutes left, right? So, okay, what I want to do is this. I want to give you, remind you maybe from your own education, a tiny bit about what an ethical will was. An ethical will that we've probably read about at some point. And then I want to look at a bunch of wills, and I think I want to leave, we'll do questions and discussion as we go through these wills with my direction, and then we will leave time to do some thinking and writing a little bit at the end. So I'm hoping to really get there and not end up eliminating that. So we may have to decide, okay, we've thought enough about it. So where do we start? We start with ethical wills, Hebrew ethical wills. You might remember having read one or two of these in your required medieval Jewish history class if you studied here. I don't know about the West Coast. And these are all written by men, and they are all medieval one time or another, and they're beautiful. Right, they're written in Hebrew. They are part of our Jewish legacy, and you could even just start there and be done. You could just work with your people that you work with, and as an exercise, have them write an ethical will, and that's already an enormous accomplishment to do that with people. So, for example, Eleazar of Mainz died 1357, but left a document, and his grandson had it. My grandfather's testament to his children. It's about 8 pages, but I'll read a couple sentences. A worthy testament, whose ways are ways of pleasantness, proven and seemly for publishing to all the people. These are the things which my sons and daughters shall do at my request. They shall go to the house of prayer morning and evening, and shall pay special regard to the tefillah and the shema. As soon as the service is over, they shall occupy themselves a little with the Torah, the Psalms, or with works of charity. If they can by any means contrive it, my sons and daughters should live in communities not isolated from other Jews, so that their sons and daughters may learn the ways of Judaism. I earnestly beg my children to be tolerant and humble to all, as I was throughout my life. Should cause for dissension present itself, be slow to accept the quarrel. Seek peace and pursue it with all the vigor at your command. Even if you suffer loss thereby, forbear and forgive, for God has many ways of feeding and sustaining his creatures. Be very particular to keep your houses clean and tidy. I was always scrupulous on this point. For every injurious condition and sickness and poverty, and it probably refers to demons in the Hebrew, are to be found in foul settings, in foul dwellings. And, oh, my sons and daughters, keep yourselves far from the snare of frivolous conversation, which begins in tribulation and ends in destruction. Nor be ye found in the company of these light talkers. Midot coming in here. And finally, at the end, he's discussing his grave, his tomb, what it should look like, where it should be. Wash me clean, comb my hair, trim my nails, so that I may go clean to eternal rest, as I went clean to synagogue every Shabbat. Dot, dot, dot. every four cubits they shall wait, they shall stand and wait a while, doing this in all seven times, so that I may atone for my sins. Put me in the ground at the right hand of my Father. And if the space be a little narrow, I am sure that he loves me well enough to make room for me by his side. So, there are dozens of these that are, you know, our heritage. And that's what we have. We have their rabbinical rulings. These are men who are known mostly for other reasons. People that were literate enough to write rabbinic responsa and codes and other things like that often wrote these testaments, and that was a part of their world, to do this as their legacy. Right.
As, yeah. Were they written in Hebrew?
Yes, they were. They're all in Hebrew. So
all this in Hebrew. I have that volume at home, and I think I probably looked there.
Yeah.
Can I see the front? I think I have it too.
Yeah, you probably do. We talked about how these were assigned in rabbinical school, graduate school.
The ones that we have are only because the authors were famous for other reasons, or we have.
Yeah, I think there's a couple for people that weren't, if they find them in manuscript, but they're mostly all heard of. Even Maimonides wrote one.
Right.
Okay, so I'm falling apart. I don't know. I think there's a new edition of this that's available. Okay, none of these are by women. What's the other side of what is one other side of preparing for the end?
Well, practically, what you're going to do with your possessions?
Yeah.
And I mean, because how you want to distribute to your children, for example. And what do you want to tell your children in practical terms?
Yeah, some of that was practical,
probably
how to get
there.
Buried and all of that.
Yeah, but, you know, because I did an ethical will a few years ago, and I was thinking about it. Some of it was, well, what jewelry and things I want to give to my daughters and daughters-in-law and granddaughters, and how I want my books to be distributed,
okay.
And also how I want them to behave in terms of...
Practically, you're talking about then combining an ethical will,
exactly,
which is just about the ethics of what the legacy of what you believe and what you've learned in life that leads to the good life, right? Not the good life, but a good life in the eyes of God, a salvific life, really, a saved life. So in terms that we're more comfortable from Christianity, right? But then there's the other side. What happens to my goods and possessions?
But isn't that ethical in and of itself? As soon as you say, okay, Shmuley gets X because.
Okay, if you say that.
If you say because, or even if there's
and
a known reason
don't.
Of
even
because.
Even if you don't, if you disinherit somebody, there's probably a reason that
right.
other people are taught.
Right.
Right?
So
you have created that person's reputation too. By letting it be known. Okay, good.
So, but then isn't there an ethical that goes with the material, even if it's not stated?
That's a great... We're going to look at some wills and see if we see that. That's a great question, and I think there probably is, insofar as that person might know why he or she was disinherited or got gifts above and beyond what was expected, right? Or, especially in the pre-modern world, where they knew what was what and what was up, because... In certain times, at least, these would have been read out loud, and not just with a small group of people and behind closed doors, but they might have been read out loud in a more public setting. People knew. And also, if somebody suddenly has money, we know, right? Let's hold a little bit. Hi, welcome. Please don't mind if I don't totally catch you up, because our time is so short.
Apologies for being late.
Okay, so... The ethical will as a genre, the ethical will as a genre fades out a little bit. We don't have this genre from the early modern period. This is a medieval genre, okay? And we also don't have from that earliest time period, 10th, 11th, 12th century, we don't have their... dispossession, what do you call it? I just lost the word.
Testament.
We don't have the testaments for their monetary value, you know, their estates. I forgot the word, I'll come back to it in a second. We don't have that, and we don't know so much, whether that's because they got lost, or they weren't written in the first place, or they just followed Jewish law. I don't know so much about that. We do have those, though, from fairly early on, as soon as there are archives, as soon as states begin to keep archives, because I jumped ahead. I was telling you that ethical wills are a genre which disappear. However, they reappear in certain documents, including autobiographical works, where you can see that there was a tradition of maintaining the ethical will in some way. And the first autobiographies of Jews are 16th and 17th century. I'm going to read you one paragraph, for lack of time.
My favorite books.
This is one of the better translations. The Lowenthal that everybody has in the brown, red cover is not a good translation, not very complete. And there's a better one in Hebrew, Chava Trinyansky. So with edit, with
footnotes. She wrote in what? In Yiddish?
She wrote in Yiddish. Chava translated her into Hebrew.
Yeah, I know.
Full. Okay. So this is a full autobiography written already after her first husband has passed away. But she does say on the second page, she's speaking to her children. So the whole book is written to my children. My dear children, what need I to speak longer on this? She's talking about how much she loved her husband. I began writing this with the help of heaven after the death of your pious father to stifle and banish the melancholy thoughts which came to me during many sleepless nights. We are strayed sheep that have lost our faithful shepherd. I have spent many sleepless nights, and for fear of falling into a melancholia, I arose and spent the time writing this. I do not intend to write a book of morals, says she.
Exactly.
For I am not able to do so. Our wise men have written such books, and we have the Holy Torah from which we may learn what is useful and what will lead us from this to the future world. She gives parables, she gives exempla, she refers to books that are in print that she has either read or been read to. Some read in translation, some available in the Yiddish print. So one of the reasons that we have a transition from the medieval ethical will later into the early modern form of ethical will and the disappearance of the ethical will is that there are books in print now, and it's not the rare rabbi who has a manuscript who knows these things. Right, so you just need to understand there's a kind of democratization of knowledge, and people buy these books and keep them by their bedside, and they give the books to the children. Okay, so there is a shift historically in what's happening. Let's read from a text, one text. I've kind of put them in not exactly... Oh, don't go to the... Yes, go to the very first one on the back of my little title page. You like how I cut and paste? myself and put me right in the center.
Come in first.
Oh, thank you.
I did that
3 minutes ago. Okay. All right. We'll read a little bit excerpted from a translated archival document and originally in form of Spanish. Let's just go around. The will of gentile wife of Jacob of Cerda in the Pyrenees, 21 November 1306. Just read a paragraph of life. Don't worry about the how you pronounce the names. Gentile, wife of Jacob Abrae Cohen the Jew. And where it says dot, 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 that is legalese that we don't need to read. Will you begin?
Yes. I make and draw up the will of my goods, ordering, etc. In this will, I constitute as my representative and executor in this, my last will, the aforementioned Jacob, my husband. Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
Keep going?
Yeah.
I apportion out to myself for my goods 100 Barcelona soldidi for the benefit of my soul, which I order to be given and distributed for my soul within 1 year on the order of my aforementioned husband and the heirs of everything written below.
That's good.
I leave Eludia my Did I?
Yeah, probably Judea. Judea.
Judea, my daughter, wife of Aviv Salamanus of Barcelona, Jew, for the part of her inheritance by right and which is owed to her, 5 soldidi worth of my goods. I institute her as my heir in these goods and the dowry of, or part of the dowry which I and my aforementioned husband gave to her and her husband on the day of their marriage, and is contained fully and best in the document of their marriage vows, and unless
dot, dot,
else
dot.
Dot, dot, dot.
Oh, well, that's neat.
What do you like about that?
There's stuff mentioned in the ketubah that goes above and beyond what we're used to seeing.
Well, we can stop for questions, and then we can also come back to it as a whole. What do you mean, above and beyond what we're expecting?
I institute her my heir to these goods, whatever those goods are,
mm-hmm.
and it's contained fully and best in the document of their marriage vows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so?
So there's beyond Meten Zuzeh, the Chazirech Midoraita.
So you don't have
ketubah.
A stock, a text
you have
only?
A, you don't have,
you
stock.
Have a list.
There's no ketubah.com. The you know, Ashkenazi contributor.
Well, actually, there probably was by now, but not Ashkenazi. But there's an additional list, sometimes attached to it as a separate document, sometimes written down at the bottom of a document, right below all the signatures.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Also, leave Regina, daughter of Goyo, my late daughter, for the part of the inheritance belonging or owed by right and succession of her aforementioned mother, 5 Barcelona and soldini. And I institute her my heir in these goods and in the dowry, however much it was, which Goyo, my daughter, and Astro, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, just got blurred.
Jew, her husband, read that part, had and received whilst living at the time of their marriage, for my goods and for my husband, just as is contained best, as to the words written therein in the documents of their marriage vows, and unless anything else, etc.
Dot, dot, dot.
So is this in addition to what they had received in their ketubah?
So this
are you going to go back
this
in?
Is, no, I'm not going to go back, because these are difficult to know, because we don't have their ketubah, right? We almost never, in fact, never, no historian yet has found both the Hebrew ketubah and an archival document which discusses the same money and things like that.
That'd be wonderful.
Nor do we have, unfortunately, unbelievably, a Hebrew written will and a notarized archival Latin or Spanish or Italian will which can be compared. Right? This drives me crazy.
Well, did they do it in both languages?
Well, this drives me crazy. Because in very rare circumstances, with very elite, rabbinic elite, or other elite, there were a few of them, in the early modern period, a little late, a century or two later than, 2 centuries later than this, we see references in the wills of those men to there being another document. But no one's ever found one. And so this is, I think, unproven, right? Don't assume it. Wonder if it's there. You know, I used to rub a lot of people the wrong way because I'm a minimalist. I don't know if they had it or not. I'm not sure why they would need to have it. Why? Jewish inheritance law is a law of intestacy. Okay? If you don't have a will, this is what happens. If you want something different to happen, you have to write a document. Right? So what happens for women according to the basic Jewish law codes?
They only inherit if there's no sons.
This is what they inherit, you're talking about, from their parents.
Yeah.
So let's take...
Well, in the case of the death of a husband, she's given a certain amount, and the rest goes to whoever the oldest son is who'll be inheriting. So she gets...
Children. Well, all the kids inherit.
No.
All the kids inherit.
I'm on top of this. So, Let's get this one.
That business with the oldest son, that's Scottish law.
Well, it's biblical law.
No, they all get it. The oldest son gets double, but they all get something.
This is Mishnah Torah, right above.
Aval. Aval Kodem.
Yeah.
Aval Kodem v'chol Adam b'irushat ishtam.
Okay, this is all we need.
You can continue, yeah, but the rest of it there is about
the husband inherits from the wife.
Husband inherits everything from the wife.
But the wife does not inherit from the husband.
Correct.
Right.
Okay?
So we just start from the very, very basics. If in the law of succession, it's a very simple thing as far as women go. When she dies, her husband inherits it. And the reason I'm focusing on that right now is that we're looking at the wills of women. Okay, we're not doing today the wills of men. So let's just focus on that for a moment. But she can, quite apparently, do something other than that.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I want to point out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we know about this woman at all?
Is she Devka dying, or is she just being smart and doing the pre-planning with no clear vision of the future?
Okay, that's great. So, this one doesn't say, but in general, and this is from looking at most wills, okay, women wrote their wills at a certain point in their life, at two points in their life. Let's think about this. First of all, two categories of women, legal categories of women, life cycle categories of women, wrote wills: married women and elderly women. Married women and elderly women. Aren't all women married or elderly? Kind of.
Widowed.
They were widowed. If they were widowed, though, young and not remarried, this is not a time of life when they were normally writing wills. So why married? And
because every time you had a kid, you put your life in jeopardy.
Punto. So every time you have a child, you're putting your life at risk. Okay. So they're often pregnant or just married and anticipating pregnancy, but most often, you know, pregnant, and they're worried about dying in childbirth.
Mm. Mm.
You said the default is that position, but they could do otherwise. In the religious community, would that have been upheld? If she had the wealth, died, and Davka did not give it to her husband but gave it to the Bikur Holim, you know, that would be upheld.
So you always have litigious people. There are always litigious people who will go to court and say, the wealth that she thought she was giving away isn't really hers. That she's claiming that wealth that she had was part of her dowry, but we, the sons, or we, the half-siblings, or whatever, actually say that wasn't really her dowry. She had already collected her dowry earlier. You're allowed to do that. You don't have to wait till you don't even have to wait till your husband dies to collect your dowry. So they would, you know, people could make all kinds of claims. People can always make claims. However, the catch is, these are written for the law courts of the state, of the local law courts. It is not new that Jews go outside of a Jewish community in order to write their and notarize their contracts. And
but then they would have to be in
so they were outside
Latin
the Jewish community.
Or whatever they were using.
They were in the language of the time.
Yeah, probably Latin. The 13th century, probably Latin.
Yes. We move into Latin for centuries, actually. We have Latin for centuries.
Yeah.
Okay. So in this document, we might come to the role of the husband. He and her sons, in the last paragraph, are universal heirs. Universal heirs means after she gives off her gifts to various people, to people who are meaningful to her, or who are expecting or not expecting, afterwards, the husband and sons are universal heirs, which is also different from just her husband being her universal heir. She is already distributing to her children, whereas standard Jewish law would assume that her husband's her heir and that her sons, through him, are his heirs, that it gets passed through the generations. She's making sure that it gets passed through right then and there, from her will. And then she goes back to reverting to the other heirs should one of her sons or husband die without legitimate heirs already, because things are passed
through the male line in any event. These heirs don't include the daughters who exist. This is interesting because scholars are, I don't know why it's that interesting to debate about this, but scholars are interested in whether women inherit or not, or whether it's always gifts. Right? Are they part of the line of succession halachically, or is that impossible always? And if you see that, that's always done through secular law. What we do know is that emotionally, psychologically, and sociologically, the dowries and the gifts that girls are given are their inheritance. Okay, the monies, the wealth, and even the possessions are divided up. And they are given early to the daughters as their dowry. Now that's the way it was. But this will, does it include that ethical component that you were suggesting, or a moral ethical, does it make anything explicit?
Not explicitly.
Okay, so you would have to know much more about circumstances to see anything like that here. Okay, let's go.
Can I ask one question? Mm-hmm. Why are there 8 witnesses?
Ah, great. Well, you're going to see this on our other wills also. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Is there any implication to the use of the words "I leave to" as different from the end, "my universal heirs"?
Yes. Because universal heirs are people who get everything left.
What is the connotation of the phrase "leave to"?
That's according to the law of legacy.
So is that a gift or inheritance?
Gift.
That's gift language.
It's gift language. So the witnesses, if you flip the page, let's see. Oh, I didn't include that. I did. How many have we got? Well, just to answer that question without reading ahead, you see where it says 7 August 1574? Last will and testament of an Italian Jewish woman? We can count. I never did this before. In the first paragraph, I'm going to come down to the place where there's footnote number 3. This is being written outside the walls of the city of Florence, mm-hmm. in the shop of Cosmo Sandri Battiste, the ironsmith, at a place called At the Springs. In the same place, present, and here's a list of witnesses, Cosmo, the ironsmith, Agnolo, an ironsmith, Luigi, an ironsmith, Filippo, a poulterer, Johannes Benis, somebody or other, and Andrea Cionis, and Matteo. That makes 8. That's really interesting. So I'd never noticed that before. So I'll bet there's some Latin law, Roman law, which is where these laws all derive from, which calls for 8, but I don't know. Somebody would know that. I hadn't thought about that before. Thank you. The next will that I want to show you on the quick side is an American will, a New York Jewish will. Do we have among us anybody besides Marion? I think you're also a lawyer, is that right?
Me?
Yeah,
no, just my father, my daughter, and my brother, and numerous other relatives.
I have the same problem. Anybody else in here a lawyer also? No, okay. So this is a collection of wills of New York. They're down there in the archives, municipal archives here in New York. It's a collection of them, okay. And this one's by Esther Brown. It is not in Latin.
Hardly.
Okay, this is the original English. She's of a Sephardic family, as most but not all were in 1708. Let's continue. Where were we? I'll read 3 or 4 lines. In
20th day of May in the year 1708, I, Esther Brown of New York, widow being sick in body, but of good and perfect memory, thanks be to Almighty God, calling to remembrance the uncertain estate of this transitory life, in that all flesh must yield unto death when it shall please God to call, do may constitute, ordain, and declare this my last will and testament, in manner and form following, revoking, and annulling by these presents,
all on every testament and testaments, wills and will and wills heretofore made by me, and declared either by word or writing. And this is to be taken from my last will and testament, and none other.
And first, okay, let's go on. I think we have the point there. This is the one that counts.
This is the one that counts.
It also means that she did some before. Uh-huh. Yeah. This is not her. This is not her first one.
Because this does not sound like completely notarial or clerk format, you know, that it's fill in the blank template, right? This is not completely template.
She wrote this. Or somebody wrote it.
Mm-hmm. Some of this language is what you use before you give a gift, knowing all other things you might have said.
And first, being penitent and sorry from the bottom of my heart for my sins past, most humbly desiring forgiveness for the same, I give and commit my soul unto Almighty God, in whose trust and belief assuredly to be saved, and to have full remission and forgiveness of all my sins, and that my soul with my body at the general day of resurrection shall rise again with joy through the mercy of Almighty God.
Yeah, this sounds almost like a vidui, you know.
That's it?
Well, if you look at the bottom, you'll see who her husband was.
Pardo Brown.
Oh, the minister of Sherith Israel.
She was a good rabbit.
Do you come and enjoy this, or you need to stand there?
I'm rotating.
Okay, good. We can stop there for a moment and just talk about what you see here, what you hear.
Well, I find it interesting, this general day of resurrection shall rise again with joy, and I thought, it almost like she's saying, there are Christians out there. Don't worry about me. I believe in this at the proper time. Mm-hmm. That was my gut reaction to that comment.
Well, somewhere which is that she'll be saved. I think there is Christian language in here, and I think that's not surprising. I think in 1708, in New York City was not the Jewish haven that it is today.
Yeah, right.
Could you translate that into Hebrew, though, if you would?
Let's see.
I don't think she knew Hebrew.
Believe assuredly to you. Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
I give and commit my soul unto a cutting.
Translate what into
Hebrew?
Which part?
Take the
resurrection,
Tiyat
HaMetim.
It's all.
Yeah. It's all Jewish.
Give us a whole sentence, maybe.
Beit Yishan Va'ira. Vim Luchi.
So, you know, just go on in your head and translate this out of the English, out of the Christian sounding language.
Kol ha-chata'im v'avonot v'ashati v'shiti
v'shiti.
Yeah, see. That was the one that really jumped out at me. That's a resurrection one. That my death should serve as an atonement for anything.
That's not a resurrection. That's not a Sanhedrin.
Well, I was going to say, you know, that's certainly in the vidui.
Absolutely.
So how does it sound now?
It sounds
Jewish.
It sounds
Jewish.
It's good.
Well, I will just say that I once leafed through a prayer book that was used in the Cuban Jewish community, which was in Spanish and Hebrew. So I looked at the Spanish. The same prayers in Spanish sound totally Christian.
Okay, I'm making a point, too. Okay, you're making a point. You're discovering a point.
We wouldn't today in the English use saved. That's one's been put fully into the Christian.
Right. No, it has a lot of connotations.
We still use Mechayem Etim.
We say it in Hebrew.
You probably wouldn't put it in English.
We also use poder.
I'm just saying in English, you do not use it.
It's in a very important point, you know, and if you look at sign theory, and if you're interested in criticism, critical theory, you would learn that part of the signification of a symbol, what does it mean? That signification is determined in part by the language in which it's said. So what's intuitive to you now that you look at it more closely and translate it into Hebrew, that the language for us is meaningful. But it's not necessarily influenced by Christianity, except for the language which is being used. And perhaps she's writing in English because that's what's going to be upheld in court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. So let's go on. It's really... it's incredible what happens, you know, when you start to think about the meaning. First of all, you're learning that she believes in resurrection.
She is believing in the immortality of the soul and the resurrection. And people that say this by rote don't necessarily believe it. But if you say it in your own language, you might start thinking about it and believing in it even. I desire my body. I forget where we were, but let's go back
that's
to
right. I think that's where we are. Sure. I desire my body to be decently buried, and now for the settling of my temporal estate and such goods, chattels, and debts as it hath pleased God to bestow upon me. I do order, give and dispose the same in manner and form following. That is to say, first, I will that all debts and duties, I guess that is, as I owe in right or conscience to any manner of person or persons whatsoever, shall be well and truly contented and paid, or ordained to be paid within a convenient time after my decease by my executrix, my dear and loving daughter Abigail Brown. Item. I give and bequeath the remainder found belonging to me to be equally divided between my four children,
those four,
Josiah, Abigail, Sarah, and Simcha Brown, allowing over and above their equal portions the sum of £3 to my dear and beloved son Josiah Brown, together with my blessings, in witness whereof I have set hereunto my hand and sail in presence of Josiah Bueno and Abraham of the city, merchants and dates signed above.
Now note, she's the widow. She's the widow, so she doesn't have to and can't appoint her husband to be her executor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so
she chose a daughter, not her son.
She did?
Yes.
That's interesting.
We know that Simcha is a girl. I mean, there are men named Simcha.
We don't know. And Josiah is also a boy.
I'm sure.
Josiah is a boy.
Simcha was a guy.
I'm assuming.
I might give all the assumption on my part.
Okay, not important to me right now, right?
That's right. That she points to Abigail.
But why
if her
not?
Daughter is also an heir, can her daughter be an executrix? I don't think we do now.
Apparently.
Yeah, sure you do.
We do?
Yeah.
So can I ask you a question, because we're reading this in a little bit more detail, these documents and dialogues. I really want to get to our next one.
Okay.
But can I ask you a question about your own role as rabbis? As rabbis, are you the ones who read the will aloud? Or does a lawyer do that?
This type of will?
The lawyer.
It's a matter for provincial or state law.
Mm-hmm. I know that.
And we're not lawyers in that regard.
As we file with the court.
Mm-hmm. I know that too, but the moment of
reading it, though, is not the same.
Reading it aloud or discussing it with the mourners in that room.
Mm.
Never got to do it.
No. Never done.
No. Okay. My mother-in-law just died this past fall, and first of all, the executrix is my sister-in-law, and this the state was divided equally. And the other thing was, she took the will into the attorney's office, and nobody else.
There isn't a ritual.
Jewish ritual around. This is just the first thing to think about. There's no Jewish ritual.
Right.
And what about the writing of the will? So note that in the wills that we've read, this one has only four witnesses listed at the end. But the writing of the will itself, I think it's done in the lawyer's office, usually. Yeah. I did one when my first child was born, and went and thought, got to think about guardianship and got to think about all of that. So, not, mind you, because I was afraid I was a dying child, or thank God, but because, once a child is born, you have to think about the child's future.
Mm-hmm.
And lawyers are involved. So one thing to tuck away in your pocket is that supposed to be a private and illegal experience?
It's fascinating because this came up for me recently because my parents wrote a document creating a trust out of a property they have. And the first two pages are an ethical will. And it was sort of about the values that are invested in that property for them and what they want seen done with it. And I was sort of stunned. They're secular Jews, but that this had happened in a lawyer's office. Like, it was just sort of stunning to me.
Is it at all possible that this will is a rewrite for an entirely different reason?
Like what?
Like, when does New Amsterdam become New York?
1654.
Yeah, this is the one. This is Bronx.
Is it 1654?
Yeah.
That's the year I had in mind.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, if she's writing a will and considering four children, it's possible she's of the age where she might have seen both realities, both equal realities.
Yeah, but there's a lot of them. There's hundreds of them collected in the book. In fact, if you look at some of the other ones in this book, you will see them describing their actual chattels, some of whom are human. Mm-hmm. And they've got slaves.
Well, they had slaves in New York.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So you can see them all in this text. And if anybody wants the reference, I forgot to write it out. I meant to write down the name of the book. So
if you look it up under the title, you'll find
it. Yeah, it's just a blank. So what I want to show you from here are what you can learn. So you can begin to see not her values with regard to whom she's giving what, but you can begin to see her religious beliefs. Mm. And, of course, you can learn a lot about her social history and whatnot like that.
Did you see, I mean, this is fascinating to me, this addendum by Thomas Wenham, the lawyer. You saw it because you crossed out, crossed out the Holy Evangelist.
He did. Thomas Wenham crossed it out.
I see, and put in the five books of Moses.
Yep, mm-hmm. Thomas Wenham himself crossed that
because
out.
Because I'm sure he's not Jewish, he makes wills for everybody.
Everybody. Yeah, that's right. So we have women writing wills so far, right? We have women writing wills. We have women who we saw one are not so interested. They don't need, nobody's pressuring them to simply turn their entire state over their husband. It's a custom to express your will. What's a will? You know?
Your desire.
Your desire.
Your wish.
So a will, it's not just this legal word that we've inherited, but it's your desire, it's your wish. Then you have their beliefs. Then I would like you to spend, we would like to spend now time on a document that I translated from the Latin. And from this document, there's a lot more. I mean, I chose this one on purpose. It's a lot of work to translate a Latin document in written and manuscript form, you know. So I really spent some time trying to get this one right. And we'll skip who all is there, but please notice that they're not Jews. She is at a notary's office, and these people are gathered among her, if she's actually there, which I believe she is. It doesn't matter whether or not she's really there. We don't ever know that. So these weavers and ironsmiths are the witnesses. These are local folk. These are the local folk in the neighborhood. This is a relationship between Jews and Christians in Renaissance Italy that I work with. And such a place actually exists. It's 1574. And here comes the stock phrases, the right out of the books, how do notaries write things, because notaries in this society, like earlier, are the lawyers of the time. You only get a lawyer if there's an enormous problem, big case, and then you get a doctor of law who comes in and charges billions of dollars. But these are notaries, the people that you go to for contracts. And there's a price for a contract. As nothing is as certain as death.
Taxes.
And nothing is uncertain as the hour of death. Here, Domina Ginebra...
the deceased daughter.
Daughter.
The Q means deceased. The
Thank
daughter.
You. Okay, deceased daughter of Magister Angelus Blanis Ebreo, Jew, and at present wife of Angelus, son of Moisha, Jew of Perugia, living in the city of Florence, healthy, thanks be to God, in body, sense, and intellect, wishing, while she still yet bears a rational mind, that she shall be able to dispose of her temporal goods. It's actually interesting to note that they had dementia then. Like they didn't...
That's legal, yeah.
Okay. According to the best mode, by way of law and form, in the great and best way possible, she was able to render her last oral testament, which was dictated without writing, to make her last will. She was her own procurator. She enacted it. She undertook it. And she set it in order in this mode and form.
Okay, so this is important because this... template is saying that she dictated this. Okay, so she's dictating and she's not writing. She was actually literate. She was literate in Italian, at least, but probably not in Latin.
and she was, and these had to be written in Latin.
How do you know that she was?
I know her. She was the owner of a silk manufactory, which employed people. She was a member of the Silk Guild in Florence. She was not only one of the very few women in that guild, but she was one of the only, she was not only one of the few, one of the two Jewish women in that guild, and one of the five or six Jews in that guild, but she was the only woman in that guild at the time. So she was an unusual lady, but not extraordinarily wealthy. In fact, she's modest. She's really middle class for her time and period. Give us a paragraph each, okay? And we're going to save discussion till the end, but please feel free to underline and star things that you would like to talk about. And what we're looking for in this document is, what are her values? And how does she integrate her values with her dispossession of her goods?
That's my question.
Yes. How are those? This is the one that we're going to look at. First paragraph.
First, that she recommends her soul to God Most High, and wishes her body to be buried in the usual place where all the Jews are accustomed to be buried, with those ceremonies that shall be seen as fit and pleasing to her stated heirs.
Item, in conformity with the law of legacy, she leaves and bequeaths to the Opera of Santa Maria del Fiore of the city of Florence 3 small lira in accordance with the ordinance.
Item, by the law of legacy, she bequeaths that her stated heir shall spend for the mediation of the souls of the testatrix
herself.
Okay, within 10 days from the day of the death of the testatrix, 10 scudi, in oil or candles or torches.
Item, by the law of legacy, she leaves and bequeaths to the Society of the Misericordia of the Jews of the City of Florence 10 scudi of 7 lire per scudo.
Item, she leaves and bequeaths that her stated heirs shall be held to disburse 10 scudi for the instruction of Jewish boys.
Item, she leaves and bequeaths for the love of God and the remedy of her soul 10 scudi to Jewish paupers, which 30 scudi of these 3 bequests, i.e. this one and the 2 just listed above, her heirs must expend within 2 years from the date of the death of the testatrix.
Item, by the law of legacy, she bequeaths that her stated heir shall be held and obliged to disburse for the marriage of 8 Jewish girls 80 scudi of 7 lira per scudo. That is 1/4 of the 80 scudi each year, 20 scudi for the dowries of the 2 above said girls. But they shall not be required to initiate the dispersal of the said dowries until 2 years have elapsed from the day of the death of the said testatrix, so long as in the end the result is that there shall be scudi for each of the said girls and that each year 2 will be married.
Item, by the law of legacy, she leaves and bequeaths that her stated heir should be held after 6 years from the very same day of her death to expend 20 scudi on a silver lamp and a parament, a curtain for the ark, that, as she states, however, the Jews shall call mine.
In all else, both her goods, movable and immovable, her named legal holdings, and those actionable, present, and future, she establishes and wishes Angelus de Moisius, Jewish man of Perugia, her husband, and her legitimate and natural children, to be her universal heir. And in the case that she should die without legitimate and natural children, then in such case she substitutes and wishes Angelus Laudadei, Jew, nephew of the said testatrix, to be her universal heir. And this she states and she asserts that this is her testament and her last will, in its details in accordance with the will of the said testatrix.
I love the drama with which you read that out loud. Very dramatic. Practice. Okay. Let's talk about the issue of how the distribution of her wealth and her ethical legacy are linked.
Can I ask one technical question?
Sure.
How much did you get for a... What was the value of a scudi?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it mean? What does a scudi buy? Let
me tell you
what a scudo buys.
Scudi is...
Scudo. So, for a scudo, 20 to 25 of those are what a working person with a decent job would earn per year.
Per
per year.
Oh.
Wow, per year.
Oh, okay.
A month and a half salary.
A working person, but, you know, a blue-collar worker. I mean, a skilled blue-collar worker, in our terms today. Let's talk about dowries, though, because the size of a dowry is considered by historians the key to understanding the economy of that society. So, according to Jewish law, we're not exactly talking about the mohar anymore. We're not talking about ketubah ta, which is some very small symbolic sum. But in social history terms, in order to find a decent match, in order for parents to marry off their daughter acceptably, 50 skudi would be good. 150 skudi would be much better. And if you are of the merchant class, like a silk merchant, 300 skudi would be really appropriate. And if you're a wealthy banking elite, which is a small super class within every Jewish community in Italy at this time, you want to get up to 500, 800, 1,000 skudi, which means that's your daughter's inheritance. Okay, so you have to imagine an estate being divided up. But most of those wealthier people, the dukes, 20,000 scudi.
Okay, they had guys, Jewish dukes?
What's that?
They had Jewish dukes?
No.
But no, you're talking about general.
Yeah.
General. Oh, okay.
20,000, 80,000, big money is up there. Okay? So that's your range. So how much do these poor girls get?
Ten.
Per.
But are these her relatives, or is she asking for these to be tzedakah to the community?
This is just communal.
This is the communal dowry fund.
Well, is it?
I thought
it was not clear.
Eight girls that she was going to make sure were getting married off.
Does she know who they are?
It doesn't matter.
It says, and it's 2 years after she dies. You know, it's not even clock starts ticking 2 years from the day I die.
We're talking about ethical
and she doesn't know when she's going to die.
Right.
Because date of death is uncertain. I mean, the death is certain, but the date of death is uncertain.
Right. But this is her commitment to the Jewish community, and it's continuation. So what she's saying is, I don't care who they are, but there are going to be eight Jewish girls, I am sure, who are going to need a dowry because we need to continue the Jewish community, and therefore, I'm going to guarantee that eight of them are going to be married off because here, I'm setting up the dowry for them. So I don't think it mattered who they were. I think there was probably eight poor girls, and those poor girls who didn't think they were ever going to have any money for a dowry now have it.
I like your point that there are going to be eight girls, whether or not she knows who they are now.
Mm-hmm. Even then there was a crisis.
There are going to be.
You know, we do now, this business of after I die, we do that all the time. We have bequests contingent on the death of the second to die.
Second to die?
Yeah, a couple. A will of a couple.
Mm-hmm. But is that what you have here?
No.
Well, I don't know if she's a widow, then in effect it is.
Well, she's not a widow.
She has a husband.
She was the daughter of a man who had died. She's the...
Okay. But this leaves open that her husband could die first, doesn't it?
But it's still, the bequest is made to be...
It's not contingent upon his death in any way.
No, it's not contingent on his death, but it's made... It doesn't go right away. After I die, whenever that may be, I bequeath this money.
Yep.
We do that now.
Get
I just mentioned second right. to die because it, we're working on that now.
I see.
That's why I know so much. Sure. Just we're working on it.
Well, you know, men did do that, at least in the rabbinic law. It's set up that when I pass away, my wife doesn't inherit anything. But she gets to live in my house. And she is supported by my estate as long as she lives, unless she decides to move out and get remarried.
Mm-hmm.
That's very common
mm-hmm.
for men to set that up. And there's an assumption that she's taking care of the children and she's taking care of the estate, but there's a sense of, I can't handle that level of disloyalty, you know, she's my widow forever, she's known as my widow, that's fine. But if she's really moving
at that point,
my children inherit. And she no longer needs it.
Well, also because she now has another husband.
Yeah, so that's right, but that's not what's going on here.
No.
And in fact, he lives on, and we don't know what happened to her. That's actually very
poignant for me. That as the historian who knows her for the 10 years leading up to this, or at least the 5 years leading up to this, yeah, I don't see her in the records afterwards.
So I don't.
Out of curiosity,
yeah.
In the second item.
Yeah, that's good.
It was the opera of Santa Maria.
I actually put a note by that too.
It works with the ordinance.
Ordinance.
So I guess it's some sort of town or
absolutely
municipality.
Because a lot of people that don't notice that say, why is she giving to a church?
Right.
Right. In fact, this is the Duomo.
This is the Duomo.
Opera is obviously not like singing opera.
We don't have such things anymore, but it's the operating budget. It's basically the operating budget for the cathedral.
Oh.
Well, you notice how much she left.
Yeah.
Looks like the minimum.
But that was required.
That was
the minimum required.
And it turns out that the ordinance that we're talking about is the ordinance of the Silk Guild to which she belongs. Not even a city.
It's like a workman's circle, sort of.
The guild is affiliated, with technical way, and you make your tiny contribution when you die. You shouldn't have any choice about that.
Okay, two questions. One is the next paragraph. I don't understand this 10 days, within 10 days of her death, the oil, the candles, torches. Mm-hmm. What's that about? I'm trying to
Shiva candles.
And my other question is why?
It's a lot of money. Hold on a second, guys. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, 10 scudi.
Okay, compare that to some of the others.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot.
So what is that? Go back, pre-modern Italy.
To keep the house light during the time of shiva.
For the shul. What does shul need it for?
Mediation of the soul of the.
Okay, so I have 2 points. One, synagogue needs light. This is how you provide light. I don't know whether or not Jewish communities also distributed some as a form of tzedakah. I don't know that. That would be an interesting possibility to find out. But I do know that synagogues, like churches, use candles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, second, what is this business of the remediation of my soul?
Well, I think that's like, may my death be a kapara for everything that I did wrong. Right.
It's like paying for someone to say shiva for a few months, just to make sure.
I can't help wondering if maybe they have shomrim. They have shomrim sitting with the body in the synagogue, and they need to have light for the people who are sitting on
that. They have evidence for that. I don't know about
that. But how do we know it's to the shul? Where does it?
It doesn't.
It doesn't say that.
It could be sitting with the body at home.
It's 10 days.
It's 10 days.
You're not going to have shomrim for 10 days.
Italy, they would have been buried within a day.
Within a day. So that's not happy for that.
So 10 days
I believe that... I believe that we've begun a unit of communal contributions.
Okay.
Okay. And it's not for 10 days.
She's done.
10 days.
Okay.
So I believe that she's done. She's beginning her communal bequests right now.
Mm-hmm.
The candles, and then this society, which you haven't asked yet what that means, and then the boys, and then the girls.
This society is like Hebron, Matan, and the girls.
Hebron, Kedisha.
No.
Yeah, actually. The Misericordia is the earliest form of Chevra Kedisha.
Really?
Before the Kupot or the Chevrot in a Jewish city become differentiated, they're all Gemilut Chasadim. Not Chevra Kedisha. Gemilut Chasadim merged with Chevra Kedisha. It's the same thing. There's one. In this city, in this moment, there's only one, and it wasn't formed by uniting the others. It was the first one organized, and the only one organized.
Unless
the way you read it, these other ones are already formalized, organized, kapot.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, just a second.
I'm going to overread this now because it's just too much fun. Coming back to for the mediation of the soul within 10 days from the death of Ten Skudi in oil, candles, torches, and whatnot. That's Maftir Shekalim
What's that?
All Maftir Shekalim with the Haftarah, all that is supposed to go towards Bedek HaBayit. And the language in the Maftir Aliyah there is the Chaper HaNafshotichem.
Uh-huh. So I believe that they believed in a kind of a purgatory. I mean,
but even beyond that, that's coming back to traditional Jewish sight, which we get the purgatory question.
I don't know about what you're talking about. Teach me.
The Maftir Aliyah for Parshat Shekalim is the opening psukim of Parshat Ki Tisa. And it's assumed that all the monies collected there are for Beit HaKabayit, for maintaining the Beit HaMikdash.
Okay.
And the language in that Aliyah, I think the last, I think the Sof Aliyah there is the Chaper al Nafshotechem.
Okay, so you think it's just a reference to her fulfilling that.
I think it's even the reason for her doing it that way, and the choice of the language there. It's not Christian language. That's Mamash Jewish language.
Yeah. But so it doesn't say anything in Maftir Shekalim about buying it for light. It says Bedek HaBayit, as you pointed out.
Oh, this is Bedek HaBayit, though.
Well, this is a very specific Bedek HaBayit.
This is what it, this is
without
operating
that were their needs.
So, if I could jump ahead, because I know we're out of time. I'm struck by the fact that all of this is spread out over a period of time.
Right.
And I wondered from the start, the idea that your soul is judged over a period of time, you know, the saying Kaddish for 11 months, and that the reason that she's spreading this out is because she wants to be sure that God is continually reminded that she's a charitable woman and that her soul is judged favorably.
I like that a lot. I think that it's a combination then of her having God continue to move her, to remember her. I believe that people at this time believed that their soul was in limbo for a while. But also, as you get to the end of this, I don't know if you're actually running out already. Oh, no.
Sorry.
Oh, no. So, just notice her social agenda. Okay? Marry off girls, make sure that they are integrated into the community. In her society, they could easily become prostitutes, beggars, or Christians if they don't have money to get married. Okay? Two, instruct Jewish boys. There are no schools yet in this community, and so they're going to get instructed. Within 2 decades, there's going to be a Jewish school created with a formal kupa for that school. Up until now, they're being instructed by individual teachers that are being hired. So number three, so you got to integrate the girls, you got to socialize the boys. Hmm. You have to socialize them into the ways of Judaism by instruction. Third, there's just your basic tzedakah to the poor. Right. They have to eat. Mm-hmm. You have the communal contribution one way or another to the synagogue for the upkeep maintenance of the synagogue. That's the candles. Mm-hmm. And if you think about this, the last one is actually that she shall be remembered. And you could say, I wish I remembered your name.
Beverly.
Beverly. That she's having God remember her for as many years as possible, maybe to move her soul and get more forgiveness for whatever she thinks her sins are, but also the people are going to remember her. Uh-huh. The people have to remember her. Uh-huh. She's going to put this parochet up in front of the ark.
But it's 6 years after she dies.
And they've got to keep it going.
And
you're going
to start dedicating the windows, start dedicating the seats.
Okay, so we didn't get, and I guess I half expected that we couldn't get there.
What I hope
is that as you digest this and you continue to think in the work that you're doing, what I hope that you'll actually do are find those times where you or the educators in your synagogues or in your practice, wherever, whatever that is, that you would think about having people, as they become older, think about their values and find opportunities to privately or even communally practice writing them with the idea that they might actually choose to reinstitute such a beautiful tradition of passing on their knowledge and their wisdom, which younger people don't necessarily appreciate yet, but passing it on for when it is relevant to their own children and nieces and nephews and whatnot. And also to think mindfully about their wills, maybe even to resist the legal system in which you just dictate out in legalese what it's supposed to be. Maybe you draft a will that expresses your heartfelt wishes and then get it brought to the lawyer. instead of sitting there mm-hmm. and letting the lawyers say, next, who does this go to? Who will that go to? How will the apartment be handled? How will the house be handled? Which charities are you giving to? Right? What if you mindfully work on this as an expression of your values, which people do anyway. They do it.
What if you
ritualize and Judaize this process, mm-hmm. right, of doing this, and integrate that into the legal system as part of their culture, you know, as she did. She dictated it. She didn't sit there and answer his questions, this notary. Thank you for your
Thank you.